Push this. Today is Tuesday, September 15, 2020. This is part 3 of Grand Canyon Oral History Interview Series with Kurt Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Kurt. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm fine. Thanks.
Good. May we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. After the interview last week, we were talking, and you mentioned a couple more stories about Rocky Mountain that were real eye-openers to me. I wondered if you'd be willing to recount those stories here for this interview.
Sure. Which ones do you want to start with?
Well, one of them was about couples in park housing. And I may have the story wrong, but it was a lady friend you had at the time, and you were out at your ranger station, and you wanted an extra key for her for the ranger station. How did that story work out?
So the gal I was dating at the time, she and I were living up at Takai in our teepee, and she would come up on various weekends to visit when I was staying in a one-bedroom cabin at Wild Basin. And the rule was that you couldn't have members of the opposite sex staying in your cabins or in your ranger quarters. I think I mentioned earlier on about one gal by the name of Miss Cameron, who stayed overnight at a male ranger's government facility and was almost fired for violating that rule. You also couldn't have pets. So it was just more convenient when the gal I was dating came up for the weekend. I'd usually be out on patrol when she got there, and we decided the most convenient thing would be to get a second key. So I went to Larry and said, "We need to get a second key." And he said, "Well, what for?" And I said, "Well, let's just say that my mom likes to come visit." And so he proceeded to get a key for mom. And, of course, George Wagner knew about it, the district ranger. And so we went merrily along our way, and then Larry advised me that the district ranger was coming down to visit Wild Basin for the day. So we cleaned up the cabin, and off the gal went. And George showed up, and we did our normal routine, looking over the operation, and it was time for lunch, and I said, "Well, let's go up to the cabin and have lunch." So we went up to the cabin. We're sitting there at the dining room table, which is also the kitchen table, which was also the living room table. And we're talking, and he said, "So, how's your mom doing?" "Oh, well, she's doing really well, George." He just had this smirk on his face, like, "I know what you're doing." And I want you to know that I know what you're doing.
Got it.
But don't get caught. Fortunately, Wild Basin was a good 40 minutes away from headquarters, and there weren't that many people from headquarters coming down to visit.
And it sounds like you had Larry kind of looking out for you.
Yeah. Larry always looked after his people.
Nice.
Yeah, so that was another trait I learned from him.
Yeah. makes a huge difference. You also mentioned another story about George Wagner and how his career ended with the Park Service.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what year it was. It was after I had left Rocky. I think it's probably after I had left Rocky in 79 permanently. But George was just an old-time ranger that took care of things. And he was expected to go down to Loveland or Estes or someplace. No, it might have been, it was further than Estes. So anyway, he had an evening meeting that he had to go to, and vehicles weren't in plentiful supply. So he just took his own Volkswagen Bug. Apparently, everybody in my life at that time owned Volkswagen Bugs. So he just drove down to the meeting, and he came back. Never put in for overtime. Never took a day off because he worked too much. And when he got back, he pulled up to the Park Service gasoline pumps in the maintenance area. And somebody saw him pumping government gas into his private vehicle. Well, George's thought process, as I've been told, again, I wasn't there, was, I'm not putting in for overtime. The government would have used this much gas. In fact, it would have used more gas because they were pick-em-up trucks.
Mm.
And so he just topped off his gas tank. Well, that was stealing government property, apparently. So, I believe the chief ranger was still Dave Essex at the time. And George ended up, as I was told later, getting fired for that. What he should have done is he should have put in for overtime. He should have taken a Park Service vehicle, or at least put in for use of his private vehicle and gotten reimbursed.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of doing all the paperwork, he just thought it was fair to use the gas that he would have used anyway in a government rig. And as I understand the story, ended up being fired. I don't know what happened to George after that, if he went to work for another federal agency or he went to work for a sheriff's department someplace,
mm-hmm.
or if he just said, to hell with it, I'm done with you people.
Did you have any thoughts on that? I mean, it sounds like, again, Larry was the sort of manager who looked out for his people, and if he saw one of his people doing that, he might have gone over and maybe said something about it and said, you know, look, you can use your personal vehicle, just fill out the paperwork, and you can use government fuel if you have the paperwork in place. It also sounds like George might have had, not having that sort of relationship with his coworkers. When somebody saw him doing something, they might just want to report it, just with maybe an axe to grind against him. I don't know. I'm really speaking out of turn here.
Well, that was my opinion. Somebody had it in for George. They caught him doing something.
Hmm.
The powers that be. You know, I'm sure, I think that Dave Essex, the chief ranger, and George had a very good working relationship. I don't know that for a fact. Neither one of them ever told me that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the chief ranger got put in a position where there were enough folks saying, enough folks in authority saying, you got to get rid of him, that he just had his hands tied, so to speak. And to me, it was ludicrous because George, I don't want to paint the picture that George pissed everybody off. He was very outspoken. But he was very supportive of me. Just, you know, like the story with McKee for the cabin for my mom. Like, I know what you're doing. But, you know, there's other times And, you know, George and I were on patrol one time. We were having lunch. And he said, "So what do you want to do when you grow up?" And I just turned and looked at him, and I said, "I want to be a ranger like you." I had a great deal of respect for the man. When I found out that he got fired for pumping gas into a Volkswagen Bug, which wouldn't have held more than 10 gallons.
Right.
In 1974, what, gas was 70 cents a gallon? $7 if it had been empty for 4 or 5 hours of his overtime.
Right.
So it was, you know, what it gets down to, I guess, and now that I think about it, there were lots of rules that existed then, and if you broke them, you got punished. But at the same time, there were lots of people, like the backcountry rangers, that were pushing the limits for length of hair and whatnot. So, you know, it was the 70s. It was the 60s and the 70s. And by then, it would have been the late 70s. So, Park Service was a organization that has a lot of military-like history, and you follow orders and you follow your commanders and didn't argue with them and you didn't break the rules. If you did, you ended up getting disciplined. So it was just more of the change that was in the 60s and 70s and, you know, continues today.
Okay. Well, that's very helpful to get that perspective from you.
You know, were there other things going on? I don't know.
Right.
Was it the straw that broke the camel back? I don't know.
Right.
But that one incident seemed sort of severe to me.
It was interesting. You shared a memo from George. It clearly had troubles with women in the uniform. He had trouble with hair length, and yet he was very dedicated to the Park Service. And as you just recounted, he when he saw infractions, he would let you know, his employees know, hey, I see this infraction. And I want you to be aware of it, that I know it's happening. So he was giving people second chances. And yet in this case, he wasn't given a second chance. And so, you know, then there's more to that story that clearly I don't know. So
clearly I don't know. If that'd been the only thing, I just think it was pretty severe. But
yeah,
George was dedicated to the National Park Service and its ideals.
Well, thank you for recounting those incidences at Rocky Mountain. And can you recount again how you met Ernie Kuncel, and how do you spell Ernie's last name?
K-U-N-C-L.
Thank you.
E-R-N-Y, I think. No, E-R-N-I-E.
Okay.
So I met Ernie in, 76. Yeah, and at Wild Basin in 1976, I was riding down the trail after the patrol. And a gentleman was walking up the trail, civilian clothes. I stopped to talk to him, just like you talked to all of the visitors that are coming by you.
Did he have a backpack, or was he just out there in his Oxfords walking up the trail?
Oh, I think he's probably in his hiking boots.
Okay.
In that time, I don't think Rangers owned anything but hiking boots. Some running shoes, maybe. I don't recall whether he had a backpack. He had come down to Wild Basin to meet me because I had applied for a job, a winter seasonal job at Grand Canyon. And I think he didn't, he didn't come to Rocky Mountain National Park to meet Kurt Sauer because he was thinking about hiring me. He came to Rocky Mountain National Park to see some other people.
Huh.
And since he was there, he said, I'll just go down to Wild Basin and meet this guy. Huh. So he's walking up the trail and I stopped and, howdy, how's it going? Pretty good. And he said, are you Kurt Sauer? I sort of looked at him like, how would you know my name? He said, yes, I am. He said, so I'm Ernie Kunzel from Grand Canyon. And I thought I'd come down and meet you and see who you were.
Hmm.
So I just mounted and we had a short talk, maybe 5-10 minutes, about working at Grand Canyon. And I don't recall if he actually said at that meeting he was going to hire me, but I ended up being hired. So my season ended. By that time, my season ended in middle of September. I think I ended up going to work at Grand Canyon around the 1st of October. And that started my career as being a full-time seasonal ranger with a two-week break in between each assignment. So in the winters, I would go down to Grand Canyon and work the South Rim on patrol. So September, October, November, December, January, February, March. April. Yeah. Someplace in April, I'd finish up, and then I'd have to be back to start work in May. Well, fortunately, I knew Tom Doerr and the River Unit people, and I met some more River Unit people. So I'd worked for 6 months at Grand Canyon, 5.5 months, 6 months, end my seasonal employment, volunteer for the River District, River Unit, take a one-week or two-week river trip, get off the river, help clean up from the trip, get in my Volkswagen bus. I graduated to a bus by then.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was a big deal. Had it set up so you could camp in the back of it.
Hmm.
1962 Volkswagen bus.
Wow.
Safari windows, ragtop roof, wraparound windows in the rear. A motor that I could work on. And then I'd drive 2 days, get back to Rocky, and start work. I started working May, worked till September, have a couple week break, drive down the Grand Canyon, and go work on the South Rim. So Ernie was my supervisor.
Had you heard about Ernie before you met him? Did he have a reputation that was in front of him, or did this guy just arrive out of the blue and said, my name's Ernie Kunzel, and I'm looking to hire you maybe at Grand Canyon, and let's talk?
I did not know Ernie. I had not heard of Ernie.
Okay.
But I got to know Ernie.
Hmm. Well, good. At one point, I want to know some Ernie stories. So that fall, I get this right, you finished up. This is in 76. Finished up your season, your summer season at Rocky Mountain National Park. And loaded up your VW Bug. It sounds like you still had the Bug then.
No, it was a bus then.
The bus, okay. And headed to Grand Canyon. Now, you had been to Grand Canyon a couple years earlier, so you knew, where to go and kind of where to show up. What was different in 76 on your arrival? Or was there anything different in 76 when you showed up?
I don't think there's anything appreciably different in 76 when I showed up. I was when I was at the Grand Canyon in 72, of course I lived in the canyon. On my days off, I stayed at the Ranger Dorm. This time when I showed up, the Ranger Dorm was full. So I ended up being put in seasonal quarters, which they had just created, which you're familiar with the El Tovar and the Grand Canyon train station?
Yes.
My seasonal quarters was on the second story of the Grand Canyon train station.
Nice.
And it was totally dilapidated.
Hmm.
That was just there a year ago, and went back up to the second floor. And
did you?
It looked pretty much the same.
Nice.
So, what I remember about the train station, other than that, you know, I'm living in this historic building.
Mm-hmm.
The trains weren't running at that time. Tracks were still there. And I needed space, so I opened a cupboard. And it was full of woven Native American baskets.
Wow.
The museum at the time didn't have enough storage space. And so they had taken these artifacts and placed them in the cupboards on the second story of the Grand Canyon Railroad Station.
Wow.
So, you know, Indian, Native American pot in 1972, and then, I don't know, 10 or 15 of these woven baskets, 1976-77.
Was Bob Euler still running the archaeological shop then?
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, I went through some training. I think it was 19. When was the? Forget the law. It was passed. It required us to have mandated a certain amount of training.
Yeah, because in 72, you know, it sounds like you went out to the range that afternoon, you got some food, and you were on your way to Cottonwood the next day.
Yeah, 3 days later, yeah.
3 days later, yeah.
Mule training.
So
anyway, I went through some law enforcement training.
Okay.
And more range activity. And let's see. Dave, I think his name was. Dave Swigert was my immediate supervisor.
How do you spell Dave's last name?
I think it's S-W-I-G-A-R-D.
Thank you.
And, you know, at that time, in the Grand Canyon, we had the visitors, but you also have concessioners. And they run the lodges and the cafeterias and whatnot, and they have a bunch of employees. The employees have housing. So we were basically the police force for Grand Canyon Village.
Okay.
And we were also the emergency medical response for the Grand Canyon Village, and we were also the fire department for the Grand Canyon Village. So Ernie, who at the time, I think at the time he was a paramedic, certainly the leader of emergency response, made sure that I got some training in medical field.
Nice.
I don't remember if it was winter of 76, 77, or 77, 78. It must have been 76, 77. Could have been the next one. I was enrolled in an EMT class. You had to drive down to Flagstaff to attend 2 nights a week. Became an EMT. And then the next year got additional training and became what was called an EMT-2 at the time, which was I don't know, halfway towards being a paramedic.
And we were... I'm just sorry, I'm going to jump in here. And Ernie was basically pushing this for his patrol ranger staff?
Yes.
Did you have any thoughts about that at the time?
Seemed like a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, out in the middle of nowhere, you guys are the first responders, basically. And that seemed like it was a cutting edge training above advanced, you know, just basic Red Cross first aid course.
Right. And Ernie also taught an EMT course at Grand Canyon, you know, I guess certified through some hospital or agency in Flagstaff.
Okay.
So he was training not just rangers, but he was training other employees of the concessions and maybe even some local residents.
Nice.
So it was quite, to me at the time, it was quite a complete emergency response program. We had an ambulance. So I think a good portion of the patrol rangers on the South Rim at the time were EMTs. And, you know, they responded to heart attacks, which seemed to be the most prevalent call. Older people would leave the Phoenix area at 2,000 feet elevation and bring their medical conditions with them, with their high blood pressure and other heart disease.
Right.
And arrive at 7,000 feet after sitting on a bus for 5 hours.
Right.
And end up having heart attacks. So heart attacks were a common response. They also responded to plane crashes. And probably in 78, I don't really recall. At some point I started responding to river accidents, with mostly broken bones and drownings. So, as far as Ernie goes, he was, you know, we'd be on shift together, and he'd call me up and say, let's meet over at Bright Angel Lodge for dinner, or coffee, or whatever. And I knew that, okay, I'm about to get another medical lesson.
Hmm.
All he talked about, you need to know how many milliliters, and you need to know what's HIV, and what do you do with this, and what do you do with that. So he was, you know, to me, totally committed to making sure we were well-skilled. And I forget the doctor's name at the time, but there was a doctor at the clinic and a nurse. And we were expected to spend some of our time up there if there was a patient, even if it wasn't our patient, just to get exposure.
Nice. And at that time, the clinic would have been operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is that right? On call at night.
On call.
Uh-huh.
The doctor and the nurse lived in the village.
Okay.
And when the doctor went away, fill-in doctor was brought in. So there was always, in my recollection, there was always a doctor and a nurse available at the clinic. I don't know for sure, but my recollection is we never had any overnight patients. If they needed to be in a hospital, then they were transported.
Okay.
So how is it now?
It's a 9 to 5. I'm not sure exactly of the hours. It's a morning to evening, 5 days a week. And if it's after hours, they're closed, and you need to go to Williams or Flagstaff for further definitive care.
So the Rangers are now transporting people to Williams and Flagstaff that are in need of further care on the weekends.
Or personal vehicles. There's a ambulance station in Tucson now, which would be new. And so I think the Rangers transport from Park to Tucson that transports to halfway to Flagstaff to another ambulance.
Oh, okay.
And then on the flag, or by air if the level of acuity demands it.
Right. Okay.
I think that's how that's working there. I could be wrong. And so Ernie was sort of 24/7, 365 on call as well, and his focus was emergency medicine, it sounds like.
Yep. You know, he participated in the law enforcement aspects. He served. He was very good at writing search warrants, and you know, we'd find out that somebody had some drugs and whatnot, and he'd write the search warrant. The magistrate would approve it, and we'd go and serve the search warrants. And he taught me how to conduct searches in a building in a residence. Very methodical, very thorough, and people were always surprised when we found their drugs.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think to look there?
Hmm.
So, yeah, he, you know, I don't want to say that he was only doing emergency medicine, but that was his passion.
Okay.
But certainly, you know, certainly involved in the law enforcement aspects. As far as the firefighting aspects, he was a member of the fire team, but most of the time he responded in the medical capacity in case one of us got hurt or in case there was a victim.
Okay. Kurt, you mentioned the magistrate. Who was the magistrate at the time? Do you remember?
Mm-hmm. I don't recall his name, although it is in the Emerald Mile book. So
yeah, I don't remember whether it was McKay.
I think that's it. Yeah, McKay.
That would be Thomas McKay.
Yeah.
Older gentleman?
Yep.
What do you remember about him?
What do I remember? He was an older gentleman, large, cheeky jowls. Rather quiet. And in my opinion, pretty much if you brought a ticket that was being contested to the magistrate's court, as long as you provided the basic details, the defendant was guilty. So,
okay.
Wasn't a big deal to go to magistrate's court.
Okay. Did he ever, you know, you mentioned if the details were provided that defendant was guilty, did he ever make any rulings that surprised you?
None that I recall.
Okay.
But I think I've mentioned previously that, you know, you're guilty of illegal camping, $25.
Mm-hmm.
You know, $50, whatever. So, yeah, he didn't make any rulings that I found surprising.
Okay.
You know, there may have been some when I thought the person was guilty and said he was innocent, but I don't recall any.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember who the fire chief was then in 1976?
I think Dick McLaren was the assistant chief ranger and was the fire chief.
What do you remember about Dick?
Yeah. Well, remember I mentioned I was trained by second and third generation rangers? Dick McLaren was the son, as was Bert McLaren, as was third brother McLaren, his name I don't recall. Bert McLaren worked at Rocky Mountain National Park, and when I was the ranger at Fern Lake for the winter and for the next several summers in Wild Basin, Bert McLaren was the one that taught me how to cross-country ski. Dick McLaren, all three brothers were raised on the west side of Rocky Mountain National Park.
Ah.
Grand Lake, I think. Not sure exactly of the town. Their dad was a ranger. Must have been in the 30s. Dick was still, 76, all the way probably up to 1980. So he probably started in 45, 46. Bert, same thing. And their third brother, who I never met, worked in Yellowstone.
Okay.
And they were just old-time rangers. And Dick had a hearty laugh. Was married to a gal, I think her name was Lady McLaren or Lady D. McLaren. And just a nice couple. And again, an old-time ranger, and you were a ranger, and he was going to take care of you and teach you what he knew.
Nice.
And one of the things I remember about Dick we were both in the ranger offices, close to the El Tovar Hotel.
And real close to the train station right there, too.
Real close to the train station. I don't know if the ranger offices are still there. They've been moved up closer to the hospital by now. But fire alarm went off, and I came jumping down the stairs and rushing up the hallway to get to my patrol car because I had to drive up to the maintenance yard where the fire engine was. And I'm running past Dick McLaren, and he's just sort of ambling out to his patrol car and drive up to the maintenance yard, half a mile away, wait for enough of us to get there, staff the fire engine, drive the fire engine down to the El Tovar and come pull him up the El Tovar Hill. And Dick McLaren comes on the radio and says, "This is a false alarm." So he had gotten over the 20-year-old, 28, 29-year-old adrenaline rush. And it's like, okay, we're going to go respond. He got in his car. He drove over, talked to the people reporting the fire, looked around. And by the time we got there with the fire engine, he had already assessed that it was a false alarm. And so this old-timer just had this approach of, okay, here we go again. Let's go find out. There's no need to rush. And that was pretty much the way he approached life, I think.
Uh-huh.
And Bert was pretty much the same way, too. One time I was packing mules or horses with Bert, and got a couple of propane tanks on a horse called Pinto, I believe. And the pack saddle slipped when Pinto was going over some rocks. And Pinto laid down, fell over. Laying down on the side, there's a steep, it's not a cliff, but steep hillside down below the trail. And I jump off my horse and pull out my knife because I'm going to cut the cinch.
Right.
And Bert's like, "Hold on, hold on." And he gets down next to Pinto and talks to Pinto and very slowly and methodically undoes the cinches. And then he He gets Pinto to stand up and walks him over and just sort of settles him down, make sure he's okay. And then it's like, okay, let's do this again. Put the pack saddle back on Pinto, put the propane tanks back on Pinto, and proceed up the trail.
Nice.
And, you know, calmer heads.
Yeah.
So what else do I remember about Dick? Just a nice man, quite mellow, and that's what I remember. I think at the time, there's a fellow there also by the name of Dave Stiglmeyer, and I have no idea how you spell Stiggy's name, but he was the lead firefighter. I think Dick was still considered the fire chief. So Dave was fire and search and rescue.
Okay. And what do you remember about Stiggy?
Very happy-go-lucky guy, always laughing. Cracking jokes, but when it came time to fighting fires, he was a good leader. Unfortunately, Dave, he responded to too many fixed-wing aircraft crashes and ended up having post-traumatic stress syndrome.
This is Stiggy?
Yeah.
Okay.
And from Grand Canyon, he transferred up to, Lake Roosevelt and had to take medical retirement. So that was not uncommon, post-traumatic stress syndrome for some of the Rangers. Maybe even for me, although we all handled it differently.
So can I just step in here for a minute and he's going to stand back and maybe vault on up to 30,000 feet and look around a little bit, because you're touching upon a couple of interesting things, and one is adrenaline, which the older seasoned Rangers, it sounds like, had a little better control of. One was adrenaline, and the other one was post-traumatic stress disorder. There were no after-incident briefing, no way to talk about, you know, the traumas of life that Park Service Rangers are exposed to that the average citizen isn't or rarely is. How did you handle those things?
Poorly. Let's see, what was the first one? The first one was in 75, maybe. 75. I had gone over to a couple of volunteers' house, where we had cookies and cake, and looked at slides of their park visits. And the gal was very nice. She was an interpreter. I don't really recall what they were. I think maybe they were campground hosts.
Mm-hmm.
But just nice folks, probably in their 50s, and she was kind of like a mother image. And they were hiking up at Bear Lake, and she had a heart attack. So word came over the radio, and Tom Powers and I lived together in Mill Creek Ranger Station. And so we were the closest to Bear Lake, and we responded as quickly as we could. And we decided we'd take the shortcut trail up to Bear Lake, which was straight up, because it would be quicker. I'm in the lead, and I hear Tom breathing not quite as hard as I am, and he's like 2 feet behind me. I said, Tom, can you go faster? He said, yes. So I got out of the way, got up to Bear Lake, and we found her and her husband. And her husband said, you got to do something. So we did CPR. We had an oxygen tank and an oxygen mask. So I cut the oxygen mask off of the tube and put it in her mouth while I did ventilations and Tom did compressions. And that was the first person that had ever died on me.
Mm.
And I don't know about Tom, maybe his first, maybe his third. So, you know, since I'd just been over to her house and I knew her, thought highly of her, you know, by then there's probably 6-7 other Rangers there. And we load her up in a wheeled gurney. Gurney's not right. Rescue sled. And transport her out to the trailhead. And then I'm escorted down to headquarters by another ranger and taken into the downstairs coffee room, and Dave Essex is there. He said, let's talk, because I was a basket case. And I remember a dispatcher by the name of Cassie walking in to get some coffee, and she's like, well, I don't think I should be here right now. So that was my, you know, post-incident debrief with Chief Ranger. And then, you know, you're done. So you're just expected to handle it. Or maybe at the time people didn't know that you were traumatized to a point where you needed additional counseling.
Did Dave give you any good advice at that time?
Well, he'd been around several homicides at Hot Springs National Monument, I think it is. Dave has an interesting history, too. I think he moved out of Hot Springs because he was taking on the mafia and what was going on in the Hot Spring hot baths.
Mm.
I'm in the 60s, late 60s. And I don't really remember much that he said, but, you know, it was comforting.
Yeah, okay.
And then, of course, Larry was like, in fact, when Tom and I and a couple other Rangers, whose names will come to me, when we lived in Mill Creek Ranger Station, we lived 100 yards above the house that Larry and Gail lived in. And I'm sure that Larry was as supportive as he could be.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, the first traumatic incident. Mm. And, you know, you respond to plane crashes. One time I was at Phantom Ranch, and there was a plane crash up on the Tonto Plateau, and the helicopter happened to be at Phantom Ranch. So I jumped on the helicopter without any jump kit, EMT kit, and was the first responder. Unfortunately, nobody, well, there was only one person that was about to die. And he was an Italian gentleman who had taken his granddaughter on a scenic flight.
Mm.
And a wing broke off and came through the fuselage and hit him in the head. And it must have also, it hit him. He was unconscious, still with labored breathing. But I get there, and Mike, who was the second paramedic after Ernie, I don't remember his last name, Mike's responding from the south rim on another helicopter. And so I commenced to do CPR on this fella that's unconscious and labored breathing, stops breathing, so I commenced CPR. And kneeling right beside me is his granddaughter, who is speaking, she's speaking in Italian or something, just pleading for us to do something. Well, fortunately, I was able to get a pulse back, and then Mike showed up with the necessary equipment, and they bundled him up and put him in the helicopter, flew him up to the clinic, and then they may have even flown him directly to Flagstaff, but he survived.
Wow.
And it was good to know that he survived.
Yeah.
Of course, the news, when I went down to see him, they gave me a hard time because all of his ribs were broken.
Ooh. Yeah, from the CPR.
85-year-old fellow. Well, you got your choice. You
yep.
can either have broken ribs or you can be dead.
Right.
Choose one. So, and Skidney, I don't know how many air crashes he responded to, but there were a lot.
Hmm.
And, there's bodies strewn all over. When a plane flies into a cliff, not much left. So he was exposed to a lot of it, and there was a fellow at Meadview that ended up having to shoot somebody after they tried to shoot him. And he didn't get any counseling. So I don't know when counseling actually came to end things. Certainly by the time I got to Olympic, we had several people killed in a helicopter crash that were all on our rescue team. And we not only counseled all the people on the rescue team, we counseled everybody that wanted to come from the entire park.
Hmm.
And I just don't have a recollection of what the progression was for post-traumatic stress syndrome counseling. But there were probably several rangers throughout the Park Service. Think back to the ranger that was shot at Gulf Islands. All the people there probably didn't get counseling. I don't remember what year that was.
Mm. And then the adrenaline, it seemed as though that's an easy trap for young rangers who want to show that they're, it's a couple different things. One is, you want to show that you're a team player, that you're willing to, jump up and run down the stairs when the alarm goes off. But that adrenaline is its own. What am I looking for? It can have its own difficulties as well. It can hurt people.
Yeah, the adrenaline rush is fine for the first 5 minutes. and fortunately, I think most folks got used to what you were doing. Especially when you did it frequently. The first several heart attacks in Grand Canyon was full of adrenaline rushes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became more of a routine.
Okay.
And I would think that paramedics today on fire departments and working for hospitals, in the emergency room, docs and nurses, when you first start, adrenaline's there, and then it's just, okay, this is what I do.
Right.
Just like Dick McLaren.
Well, it's training. I've seen this before. I know what to do. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, like Dick. So that winter of 1976, working road patrol South Rim, did you get a chance to get into the backcountry at all during that winter? I mean, it's kind of snowy and cold up on the rim, but not too bad down at Phantom.
You know, I don't think I don't recall. Well, yeah, there were a few day hikes. Go out to Hermit Rest and go down to Hermit Rapids.
Okay.
I think I tended to stay away from Indian Gardens and Phantom Ranch.
Okay.
We also had horse patrol, so...
Huh.
In the spring, I'd ride on the South Rim, but I don't remember taking any mules into the canyon during that time.
Okay, and the horse patrol was around the village area there?
Yeah, for the most part. And a lot of it was on time off.
Oh, okay.
Just ride out towards Desert View.
Oh, all right.
You didn't get to view, but you ride out towards Desert View, or you trailered the horses and patrolled, patrolled on your day off.
Okay.
The South Rim boundary.
Okay.
Which is another interesting thing that just popped into my head. You could go, halfway to Desert View, a third of the way to Desert View, and go down to the south boundary of the park a week before hunting season.
Huh.
And you could literally watch the deer and the elk jump the fences and come into the park.
Wow.
They just knew that it was hunting season. And hunters didn't come inside the park, for the most part.
Hmm.
It was uncanny. At first, unbelievable. But, yeah, and then months later or whatever it was, they'd go back out.
Interesting.
Of course, nowadays, the elk live there year-round.
Right.
Yeah, there weren't nearly as many elk in the village as there are now. In fact, it was a rare sight to see an elk in the Grand Canyon Village in the 70s.
Interesting. Okay. So that would be a nice way to sort of try to maintain your mental sanity in an otherwise what could be a very stressful job.
Any time out in the wild, whether it's wilderness or just undeveloped, is soothing for the soul. I think that's why so many people come to parks and national forests and Bureau of Land Management lands.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of beauty out there, and it's the solitude and the quiet. And, you know, folks that come from L.A. and go to Joshua Tree, even though they're around 60 to 100 people at Parker Dam, to them it's solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they even get invigorated. But, I think the rangers mostly like to hike alone.
Yeah, it's the only chance they get to be by themselves on your time off.
So I piqued your interest when we brought up Ernie Kunzel. What else do you have, question-wise?
Well, I'm just trying to think about who else was there. Somebody I remember was George von der Lippe, and he may have been gone by the time you showed up. Does that name ring a bell?
Rings a bell, but I never met him.
Okay, he was probably gone. And I'm trying to slowly think now about the river, because I get thinking, how did this work? Now, you would do a winter seasonal, and then it sounds like you would volunteer for a river trip in the spring before loading up and going back to Rocky Mountain. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And you had met Tom Doerr in 72, doing the same thing. You'd volunteered for a river trip. You mentioned that Horn Creek story with the hole in the boat. So Tom was still there in 76?
Yeah, he was still there in 76. At that time, I think he was in charge of the fee collection program.
Oh. So he was not doing river patrol anymore, or was he doing, in the winter he would do fee collection, and in the summer he would do river? I'm curious.
No, I don't know. Maybe in 76 he was still river, and no, because we were in seasonal trailers. Someplace 76 through 78, he became seed collection. And I don't recall who was running the river operation at the time.
Okay.
But, you know, back then, it may well have been Tom. Hey, you know, do fee collection and also run the river.
Right.
And then, you know, while you're at it, do this and do that.
Right.
So yeah, I would do the river trip. And
what do you remember of that 1977 river trip?
Having a good time.
Okay.
Nothing specific.
I'm still running the...
You interviewed Steve Martin, right?
I did.
So when do you recall when he started with the river unit?
I don't. I could look that up, but I don't have that
Sometime in 77, 78.
Okay.
The river unit was run by Steve Martin and Marv Jensen. What I remember about those river trips was they were oar-powered and they were 2 weeks long.
Right. And, that was just what I was going to ask you, was when do you think the transition happened from the Jack Curry J-Rig to the oar-powered craft?
I don't recall the exact year. Sometime around 77, 78.
Okay.
Steve and Marv and the crew were working on the Grand Canyon River Management Plan.
Right.
Which was a very contentious time for the river, the Grand Canyon.
What do you remember about that?
Well, I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it until 1979.
Okay.
I was South Rim Patrol and doing what we did, and there was a river unit, and I knew the guys well enough to know that I was going to get on a river trip that fall. My recollection is I don't think I paid a lot of attention to what was going on politically.
All right.
So that's what I did from 76 to 79. I'd work at Grand Canyon in the winters, take a patrol trip in the spring, or work at Rocky, at Wild Basin, and then was moved up to the Mill Creek area and worked into the fall for the hunting season, and then get in my bus and head back down the Grand Canyon, repeat.
Okay.
During that time, many of the backcountry rangers in Rocky Mountain were trying to get on permanent. And I don't know if you want me to jump ahead to that, but in 1979, I got on permanent. After about 6 years of trying to go from seasonal to permanent.
Well, I'm curious because it sounded like, it sounded like you had something that was working. I was going to say a good gig, but maybe it wasn't so good, which was, you know, working Rocky in the summers, which is pretty nice. It's a nice time of year to be there. And working Grand Canyon in the winters, which was totally different, working Village Road Patrol, totally different than, I think, Rocky in the summer, especially if you were working at a place like Wild Basin. And that might be pretty workable. What was it that was driving you to become permanent, besides that, you know, you'd have a permanent position with the park and wouldn't be working on a seasonal, temporary basis?
Just the permanency of it.
Okay.
As a backcountry ranger, you were a GS-4, and if you were lucky, then you became a GS-5. And you weren't actually a park ranger, you were a park technician. You were 2-6 series. And then, if you were really lucky, which I was, you became a GS-6 backcountry ranger.
As a seasonal?
Well, as a seasonal.
Okay.
Well, the highest you can go in park technician is GS-7.
Okay.
And I think the park technician series is actually gone now.
Hmm.
So, you know, you're absolutely right. It was a beautiful time of life. You work the backcountry of Rocky Mountain National Park, then you drive down the Grand Canyon and work South Rim Patrol and do emergency response and law enforcement, firefighting, wildland firefighting, structural firefighting, take a river trip, and then you got, in the later years, 77, 78, you got 2 days to get back to Rocky to start working. And here's a quaint story for you. But you got 12 minutes left.
Uh-huh. That's right. That's good.
So, I don't know when it was. 77. 78. Doesn't matter. I'm in my Volkswagen bus. I'm driving from Grand Canyon to Rocky Mountain. I got 2 days. And I'm going through the Navajo Reservation. I think it was Kayenta. I need to get some gas, and I've been driving with a headwind. The wind's coming out of the northeast. I'm heading northeast in this square-faced Volkswagen bus, maybe making 50 miles an hour, like 45, thinking to myself, I'm not going to get there. I'm not going to get there. And I pull into this gas station on the Navajo Reservation, and I'm all, you know, stressed out because I'm behind schedule. And I'm pumping gas, and there's this old Navajo guy leaning up against to get another gas pump. Got his cowboy hat on, boots. He's pumping gas. And I walk over to him and say, "How long is this wind going to blow like this?" And he just raises his head and looks at me and says, "Till it stops." I got back in my bus and I thought about that for probably the next hour.
Hmm.
Just the difference between the cultures.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's windy. It would be windy until it's not windy. That's my time frame.
Right.
That's his time frame. My time frame is I got to get to Rocky Mountain National Park.
Right.
Two different cultures.
Yes.
And I think that helped me almost immediately and later on in life. You know, you can set your goals, but there's going to be things that come up that you have no control over.
Right.
And you just have to deal with it. So.
Yeah. And you got to Rocky Mountain on time. And
I got to Rocky Mountain in time. Had another great summer. Summer of 79. I was going to get married on July 29th, 1979. Started work in May. And my bride-to-be and I were living at the Mill Creek Ranger Station, where she couldn't be there. With Tom Powers and maybe another ranger. And I got a call from the chief ranger of Grand Canyon. He said, hey, we want to hire you as a dispatcher. GS-3. Permanent position. I'm a GS-6 backcountry ranger, and I have an opportunity to go to work permanently as a GS-3. I said, yeah, I'd like to take that job, but I'm supposed to, this is in May, right?
Hmm.
I'm supposed to, you know, get married July 29th. I was wondering if I could report, like after that. Chief Ranger Miller, very nice man. He said, you know, I think it'd be okay if you reported on the 1st, and I'm talking, August 1st, that's good. I said, August 1st? He said, no, June 1st.
Wow.
So I packed up my gear. The gal I was going to marry moved in with Gail and Larry. And off I went, because, you know, she couldn't live there if I wasn't there. I wasn't supposed to be living there anyway, but.
What was her name? Who were you going to marry?
Yeah, the name of Connor, C-O-N-N-O-R.
So this is the same woman who George had talked to you about your mom for. Okay.
Oh, yeah, now that was my mom coming up to you.
Right.
Yeah, I was the same gal.
Okay.
That lived with me at Takahe.
And what was Connor thinking about all this?
I think she was thinking that now I'm going to have to organize the entire wedding.
Mm. You
know, which she and her best friend Pam did a great job with a lot of help from Gail. But the wedding was held in Halliwell Park, which is about a mile away from Mill Creek Ranger Station. And the reception was held at Mill Creek Ranger Station. And there were about 50 or 60 people there.
Nice.
Charlie Logan and a couple other rangers built some built some small bridges to go across some creeks so we could get to the right meadow that we wanted to be in Halliwell Park.
Wow.
And we had the wedding, and then we went to Mill Creek and had a reception. With a bluegrass band from Fort Collins, friends from Takahe.
Wow.
It was a gala event.
And then you had to boogie back to Grand Canyon.
Yeah, so we got married on the 29th. We stayed in a VIP cabin the night of the 29th of July, just a couple miles down the road from Mill Creek Ranger Station. Which, of course, the rangers had gotten a hold of. And there was saran wrap on the toilet seat. There was pine cones in the pillowcases. And starch in the bed. some of my ranger brothers went out of their way to make sure I had a good first night. We drove down through Farmington, New Mexico. Saw a mountain lion run across the road.
Wow.
And, got back to Grand Canyon 2 days later. Went to work the next day.
Back to dispatch.
Yep, back to dispatch at the time.
Okay. With Connor, and you've got to sort out some housing, because now there's two of you.
Yep, and a little animal called Black Dog.
Uh-huh. Now, wait a minute. Now, no pets.
Exactly. Which was not the first time the Black Dog had been with me to the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
Yeah. Blackie, I got Blackie out of veterinary clinic that I worked at in high school. Came back my first year out of college and worked there again. Black Dog had been hit by a police officer's car on Christmas Day. Police officer knew Dr. Sunshine. Brought him in to Dr. Sunshine. Dr. Sunshine fixed her hip as best he could and then kept her in the back kennels. And he refused to euthanize or anesthetize any animal. This was the original, as far as I know, no-kill shelter.
Wow.
So I ended up taking Blackie on hikes on the weekends and then go back to college, and she'd stay in the kennel, and then I'd come get her for the weekends, and we'd go hiking. And so 69-70, something like that. She went with me to college. And so she'd been with me since 69. There's no way I was going to leave her. She was going to the Grand Canyon with me when I worked there seasonally.
Nice. Well, maybe this is a good place to wrap up this part three, and we'll pick it up again. And you'll tell me everything there is to learn about being a dispatcher at Grand Canyon.
Yeah. With the PBX board, where you actually take the wire cords out and plug them in.
Oh, yeah, I want to know all about that. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, well, with that, this will conclude part three, Grand Canyon Oral History with Kurt Sauer. Today is September 15th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Kurt, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom. Thank you.